You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2016 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. If you've been following Gretel Ehrlich's writing over the years, you'll know her perhaps from her stunning collection of essays, The Solace of Open Spaces About the American West, or her astonishing memoir of being struck by lightning, Matched to the Heart. Among various awards and honors, Ehrlich won the inaugural 2010 Penn Thoreau Award, awarded to writers who demonstrate literary excellence in nature writing. Her journeys to various places around the world are both physical and philosophical. Among her recent books is Facing the Wave, an account of her travels in Japan, a country with which she has a deep relationship, in the aftermath of the 2011 earthquake and tsunami and the subsequent meltdowns at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. Tonight she's here to talk to us about Greenland, about climate change, about rotten ice. And as noted today on NPR, if you think today is hot, you're right. If you think this year is hot, you're right. The latest temperature numbers from NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration say the first 6 months of 2016 were the hottest on record around the planet. Beginning in 1993, Gretel Ehrlich traveled to Greenland, the northernmost country in the world, in every season. The 4 months of perpetual dark, in which the average temperature is 25 degrees below zero, the 4 months of constant daylight, and the twilight seasons in between. Traveling up the West Coast, often by dog sled, and befriending the resilient and generous Inuits along the way, listening to their narratives and observing changes in their traditional hunting. As she reminded us in her stirring essay, Letter from Greenland, published in the April 2015 issue of Harper's, what happens at the top of the world affects all of us. We're deeply honored to welcome Gretel back to Aloud. And in conversation with Gretel tonight is someone she knows well, her husband, someone whose voice you've no doubt heard over the 36 years he spent with National Public Radio. Neil Conan worked as a correspondent based in New York, London, and Washington, and has covered wars in the Middle East and Northern Ireland, Olympic Games in Lake Placid and Sarajevo, and a presidential impeachment. He served at various times as editor, producer, and executive producer of All Things Considered, and I, for one, certainly miss him, and you probably do, too, as the longtime host of Talk of the Nation and Lucky Hawaiian Public Radio. If you've been following Gretel Ehrlich's writing over the years, you'll know her perhaps from her stunning collection of essays, The Solace of Open Spaces About the American West, or her astonishing memoir of being struck by lightning, Matched to the Heart. Among various awards and honors, Ehrlich won the inaugural 2010 Penn Thoreau Award, awarded to writers who demonstrate literary excellence in nature writing. Her journeys to various places around the world are both physical and philosophical. Among her recent books is Facing the Wave, an account of her travels in Japan, a country with which she has a deep relationship, in the aftermath of the 2011 earthquake and tsunami and the subsequent meltdowns at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. Tonight she's here to talk to us about Greenland, about climate change, about rotten ice. And as noted today on NPR, if you think today is hot, you're right. If you think this year is hot, you're right. The latest temperature numbers from NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration say the first 6 months of 2016 were the hottest on record around the planet. Beginning in 1993, Gretel Ehrlich traveled to Greenland, the northernmost country in the world, in every season. The 4 months of perpetual dark, in which the average temperature is 25 degrees below zero, the 4 months of constant daylight, and the twilight seasons in between. Traveling up the West Coast, often by dog sled, and befriending the resilient and generous Inuits along the way, listening to their narratives and observing changes in their traditional hunting. As she reminded us in her stirring essay, Letter from Greenland, published in the April 2015 issue of Harper's, what happens at the top of the world affects all of us. We're deeply honored to welcome Gretel back to Aloud. And in conversation with Gretel tonight is someone she knows well, her husband, someone whose voice you've no doubt heard over the 36 years he spent with National Public Radio. Neil Conan worked as a correspondent based in New York, London, and Washington, and has covered wars in the Middle East and Northern Ireland, Olympic Games in Lake Placid and Sarajevo, and a presidential impeachment. He served at various times as editor, producer, and executive producer of All Things Considered, and I, for one, certainly miss him, and you probably do, too, as the longtime host of Talk of the Nation, and lucky Hawaiian Public Radio to have him there as a news analyst and macadamia nut farmer. So please welcome Gretel Ehrlich and Neil Conan. Thank you.
When you first went to Greenland in 1993, you brought a couple of books with you. What were they?
They were two of the 13 volumes of Knut Rasmussen, who had traveled in the 1920 to 1924 by dog sled from Greenland all the way to Point Hope, Alaska. And if it wasn't for Rasmussen, we would know very little about Arctic culture.
And what did we learn from him?
Everything. We learned that, so Inuit people originally came across the Bering Land Bridge from northeastern Siberia, and they have year by year, perhaps 20,000 years ago, first to Alaska, then through the archipelago, what we call the Northwest Passage was really the traditional passageway east for them, and they ended up in Greenland about roughly 5,000 years ago. It's one language with a lot of dialects, one life way with some variations according to where they were and what they needed to do to get food. But it's the only single culture that spans 6,000 miles just across the top. And those people didn't, it wasn't like they said, oh, we're not going to move to Santa Monica, I don't really like the beach. They didn't know there was anything else except ice.
And I got to go with you to Greenland a couple of years ago, and one of the things that I was astonished by, we just went to Ilulissat, which is a city somewhat less than halfway up the west coast of Greenland, and you think you're pretty far north, but you're not. There's a long way left to go.
Right. Ilulissat and Uummannaq are in what's called West Greenland. It's about halfway down. The island of Greenland is huge and long. But I began, because of Rasmussen, I began going to the northernmost villages, the two of them, Kanak and Siaprluk. They're at about 77, 78 degrees latitude north. And I went there because...
because of Rasmussen.
Yes, because of Rasmussen. And there was a youngish Inuit marine mammal hunter there named Jens Danielsen. Forget that he has a Danish name. He is totally Inuit. Who had done the same trip as Rasmussen did, only in the 1970s instead of the 1920s. And I went there thinking, oh, I'll get Jens to take me on the trip all the way to Point Hope, Alaska. And when I finally met him and asked him, he just laughed at me. He said, oh, no, that trip was very, very hard. You don't want to stay. You don't want to do that. You just stay here with us and travel with us, meaning his family, and you'll see plenty, which I did.
Could you, if you can, bring up slide 11?
So I'll tell you while we're waiting
and
for
that.
Slide 11. Oh, yeah, well, that's me and Jens, yeah. That's my favorite picture of myself ever. It was about 20 below that day, and we had been on a long trip, and the coldest of which was 59 below zero traveling outside. So 20 below felt really good, so we decided to stop and sunbathe.
What were the villages like when you first saw them?
Well... Greenland is It doesn't have a lot of villages, but they were vibrant. These are subsistence villages of between 20 people and maybe 75, or maybe a few more. In Connacht is sort of a town. The dog population was way larger than the human population. As you can see there, we travel on big freight sleds, not like the Alaskan basket sled, so they're about 10 or 12 feet long, 4 feet across, that we carry, and they're pulled by 15 to 20 dogs.
In a fan,
In a fan-shaped hitch, because there are no trees, and that's why they're hitched 2x2. And these dogs are half wild. They're not petted or taken into the house as they are in Alaska. So the canine population in these villages was the most... It was the symphony every night. It was just howling and howling. And in Ilulissat, actually, they're all kind of chained up on long chains when they're not, because they did eat a few babies along the way in the old days when they were loose. So they were right against a big rock wall, and it echoed. The sound of them howling and talking to each other was just delicious. It was never something that you tried to get away from. It was part of the music of Greenland.
I was astonished when I was there to realize how little of life is on land and how much is at sea.
Yeah. So what most people don't quite understand, because Greenland is a little different than the other Arctic nations, all the travel is done on sea ice. So, you know, these are kind of the Davis Strait, and on north of the Kennedy Channel are relatively narrow. I mean, on a clear day, you can see Ellesmere Island from Greenland. And of course, there nothing grows there. There are no berries. There's nothing. So they live on the flesh of marine mammals, which they hunt with the odd rifle, rusty rifle, and...
Where'd they get rifles?
They got them from Robert Peary as a present for helping him try to get to the North Pole.
Get near
the North Pole. Yeah. And they still hunt narwhal with harpoons from kayaks. They make everything themselves, except the rifles. We wear polar bear pants, sealskin hammocks, the boots, fox fur, the foxes, so Arctic fox fur, anoraks. They make the harnesses, they make the sleds, they make their own kayaks, they make the kayak paddles. So these are industrious villages where there's something going on all the time.
And this is a conscious decision. They could have snowmobiles.
Yes, they ban snowmobiles. They are sort of Thoreauvian in that they live exactly the way they want. They chose to keep all the modern traditions, and I asked them why, and they said, well, they work better. You know, we have thrived for 5,000 years in Greenland. Why would we change something that works so well?
And it is a communal culture. The hunters who go out, they're not hunting for themselves or their own families.
Well, they are. They hunt in extended family groups, but it's a food-sharing society so that everybody is fed. There is no want in these villages. So widows, hunters who have been injured, orphans, everybody, the Danish school teacher, whoever, and anyone else like me who just used to come in the springtime, we were all given food. It wasn't sold, it was given.
You talked about the culture that unites these peoples across the top of the world. There's a concept I wanted you to talk about that you write about in some of your books. It is, I guess, in an odd way, both a person and an idea. Sila.
Sila. It's spelled S-I-L-A. It's the first word in Greenlandic that I learned. It means both weather. Well, not both. It means weather, the power of nature, and consciousness. Not just human consciousness, but the consciousness of all sentient beings, including the marine mammals that they eat. And actually, it goes beyond that. The souls of animals that appear in the masks that they make for dances, that you'll see one face. It could be a wolf's face, but with a seal coming out of the mouth, which is the wolf has eaten the soul of the seal, so that in a way it is a completely all holistic, circular world in which, you know, there is no domination of one to the other. It's you're all there, out on the ice together.
And that first time that you went out hunting with them, what was it like? I mean, were you squeamish?
Oh, not at all. No, I was supposed to. There was a young woman who later became a prime minister of Greenland, but who had grown up in villages, and I'd met her a few years before, and she was supposed to come up as my translator. She speaks seven languages, and she just didn't show. It was kind of, you know, typical. and so I thought, well, I've come a long way. I might as well just go. And so I went out with two strange men who do not speak English, and I did not and still don't really speak Greenlandic. And I asked the owner of the guest house if I was going to be okay, and he said, he was sort of insulted. He said, do you think I would send you out on the ice with people who wouldn't take the absolute best care of you in the world? And I said, I'm sorry, no, I don't, and yes, I will go. And off we went for a month. And you know what the first question always is? excuse me. Where does one go to the bathroom? I mean, you know, there's sort of pieces of rough ice, and so one of them took my hand like a little girl and said, took me off to a little piece of rough ice. He said, he knew a few words of me, right here would be good. Yeah, right here is good. But it was, of course, it was extraordinary.
And the trip, of course, was catered.
Oh, yeah. Yes, right. Boiled seal, which is actually really good, and boiled... that trip, we just had seal, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. 1 year, so I've been doing this for 20 years with the same family group. 1 year, Jens brought an onion, and after about the second week, he pulls this onion out of his, you know, a Danish onion out of his backpack, and we all sort of stood around it like that, and he takes out his big hunting knife, and he drops it in the boiling water with the boiling walrus. And it was so exciting. And we were just, pulling out little pieces of onion. But, of course, the matak, which is the skin with the little layer of fat underneath it, has all the vitamins and minerals that a human being needs, which is why they haven't died off a long time ago. So we just eat that and then eat some meat and off we go.
What do the dogs eat?
Same thing. They get fed first. And I have been on trips where there was only enough food for the dogs. And we ate, I always brought packages of instant soup, so we ate soup. But you see, you won't survive without the dogs. They're your transportation. So they're taken care of beautifully.
So you are visiting this thriving society that is in large ways intact.
Totally. Language intact, life ways intact, tradition, hunting traditions.
When did you realize things were changing?
Well, it was 1996, and Jens and this other fellow and I were going across. There were two islands off from Connacht, and some friends of his from Siaperluk, Otto Simiok and his wife were out there. So everyone was going to join and hunt together. Everybody does things as a group. On our way out... spring, so there was about that much snow on top of the ice. But usually the dogs can smell if there's water or something, but they didn't. Suddenly, I heard this crashing. You know, we're just going along, and I heard this crashing like goblets being smashed. And I didn't really know what was happening, and suddenly I saw dogs disappear. So this, like, 20 dogs pulling us just start disappearing and trying to get away and this hole in front of us. And the other guy jumped off the back, and they use this big steel pole to test the ice and to do, you know, to chunk off pieces of ice that you're going to use for drinking. Anyway, he put it in the back and wrapped a sealskin thong around it to hold the sled back. And we were, and he yelled at me, just, or he, you know, said, just stay where you are, just hang on. You know, there's sort of lash ropes over your load. And I was hanging on like that, like a cowgirl taking a deep seat before you get bucked off. And the sled was inching towards this hole. And so Jens put his feet across there, leaned over the trace lines, and with one hand at a time start pulling dogs out of the water, just one hand, throwing them like that. These are strong guys, and who are so incredibly brilliant and efficient in these kinds of emergency. You just can't believe your eyes what they do. And then he got most of them out, and then he stepped off the sled on a piece of ice that had already kind of broken off. And he was a big man, and when he stepped on it, the ice started going down like an elevator. I thought, okay, bye-bye, Yancy. And, and then he leapt from that back onto the sled and got the dogs to turn, you know, a hard left and yelled at them, and off we went. I mean, no one ever said a word, and later, you know, we traveled for a few hours. So far, so good. And so I asked him in my almost non-existent Greenlandic if we were going to die. And he said, imaka, which means maybe. But then there was a little smile at the end. And, you know, I didn't really care. I just thought, you know, I'm in the presence of these extraordinary people, and there's nobody left like them in the whole world. And if I die here after they've done everything they can do to save all of our lives, I happily surrender.
The ice was weak because the warming had started to chronically mean that there was less and less ice every year.
Right. Yes, and that's what we didn't understand. And I mean, there were scientists, of course, who knew that the ice was thinning, but we didn't. And even you know, you couldn't. I asked, you know, I just didn't know. But after that event, I knew something was wrong, and they knew it too. And they sort of said, "Well, you know, find out what's going on." And so I did. So then I started a long process of educating myself about, at first, sea ice, and then the Greenland ice sheet, which is a whole nother story, and then about the feedback systems that create more and more warming, and, you know, a learning cycle which is ongoing actually every day because it's so exponential. Now, just not sea ice, but the entire, as you may have noticed, the entire world is becoming a hot place.
There are even days, you describe one, I think, where it's 59 below zero, but the waters are stormy, so ice is breaking up from underneath.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd think that cold, it would be okay.
So, yeah, so that first incident was in 97. By 2004, it was basically all over for, in terms of sea ice in Greenland. It was... Yes, when we took off, we were out going off for a month-long walrus hunt. It was 35 below zero when we left Connacht, and it got colder and colder and colder. For a while, the ice was okay. The first camp we made, the ice was so thin that it went like that under our feet, so we were told to walk single file and very carefully, otherwise it might break. During the night, Mamre, Jens's brother-in-law, harpooned a walrus, and it was brought back to camp. But the big haunch was, we were staying in a little hut. Sometimes they bring little huts out. And we were staying in this hut. So there were 58 dogs, 8 people to feed, and this haunch was dripping blood. And I thought of it as a metronome that was marking what I thought of as Aboriginal time. So this is time without days, without schedule. It was only, you're just going between one meal and the next, hoping you'll find enough food for 58 dogs and 8 people in the next place you go. And it kind of lulled us into a sense of, you know, this, it's going to be, the ice is bad. It is breaking up from underneath because it's now much stormier place than it used to be, but maybe it will be okay. And then it wasn't. And then we went on to a village called Moriusok. And we were supposed to go out to an island, Saunders Island, and we were told there was no ice at all. Or in the next village, Savisavik, none. And the look on their face, I just knew that they understood that it was basically not only the end of ice, but the end of their lives as they had known it for thousands of years.
You mentioned Moriusok. What was that?
What was that?
What village was that? What was it like?
Well, small. Mamret's wife was the great-granddaughter of Robert Peary, a wonderful young woman. She was a school teacher in town. When I asked her how many students she had, she said, well, two, but sometimes just one. She did speak a little English. She said, I'm proud to be part American. But, you know, it was another, a tiny, tiny, vibrant village. Then should I tell the rest of the story? See, this isn't really rehearsed. I can't believe the questions he's asking me. This isn't how it was supposed to go at all.
It's going very well.
Okay.
We'll get to the rest of the story later.
Okay.
You went on this trip with this big group of people, and just that one walrus.
Yeah. So that's all the food we got. So the rest of the trip, as we were moving down the coast of Greenland, everything behind us was breaking up, all the ice. So when we turned around, because there was no ice in front and very little ice in the back, we had to go up and over part of the ice sheet, which is really dangerous. It's kind of exciting. Big crevasses, and the dogs are going by. You know how dogs are looking at the crevasse. And then we sort of got to the top, and as we said, we took air going off a cornice down the other side, and then we went down this this stream bed. Of course, it was frozen, but there were just these big boulders, and there's no brakes on these sleds. You know, they put a little rope under the runners to slow it down, but it wasn't enough, so Jens would lean off and put his knee down to kind of slow the sled down, and his foot was hitting boulders, and I was just like going like this. Anyway, we got to the bottom, and we did find a place where the previous hunters had left food on a drying rack, so this would have been dog food. And they were so relieved that at least the dogs would have something to eat, because we had consumed the walrus. And then we spent the rest of the month just trying to get home. And it took weeks. And it was at the end of that, the previous slide where you see me and Jens sunbathing. We finally made it out to these islands and then back into Sjaprluk, which is the northernmost village in the world, where that gentleman was from. But it was a disaster. And the families came down to the ice when we got back, and they saw that there was no food for them. You know, they're very cool people. There was no outward display of disappointment or anything. They just helped us unpack the sleds, and everyone went home, and it was kind of quiet.
But what happens to a food-sharing culture that is fed by subsistence hunters when there's no food and when the ice that is their transportation system and indeed their world in a lot of ways, when that begins to go away?
Well, the culture dies. Well, in a practical sense, the lesser hunters, you know, there are natural hierarchies everywhere. The lesser hunters shot their sled dogs because they couldn't feed them, and they figured it was better to have the best hunters in the village go out and try to get food. So that was the practical thing. All the young people, these are young people who have been trained to be hunters. You're a national treasure in Greenland if you're a great hunter in the north. They were all sent south to learn to vocational school or, you know, to learn to be a helicopter pilot, an electrician, a cook, a teacher, whatever, things they had no interest in doing and But what choice did they have? So little by little, the villages started thinning out, and more of them, crowded into...
Consolidated.
Into Connacht, where there were a few more, there was a clinic and stuff there. But the little villages that were so precious and so wonderful just came to nothing.
Like Mauriac.
Yeah, so there's an almost Shakespearean story about Mauriac. Everybody had left except for two hunters. They went out together in a boat in the open ocean because it's very hard to hunt seals when it's open because it's dark and you can't see the animals. But they were out there and a loaded gun went off and accidentally shot and killed one of the men. And the other one, so distraught and so lonely, a sense of kind of existential solitude, shot himself. And so Mauriac is no more.
Over time, you've gotten to know more and more about the science that is behind all of this. If we could bring up slide 3 when you get a chance. And you've gotten to know some other people who work on the ice, the glaciologists, including, the dean of the glaciologist.
Conrad Steffens, he was...
And that strikingly handsome sound man there.
He was at the University of Colorado for years. He's gone back to his native Switzerland. But he told us this astonishing thing, that water vapor is now the most prolific greenhouse gas because... permafrost around the top of the world, both terrestrial and is beginning, which will be a disaster if it really happens completely, is the frozen clathrates under the sea are melting. There are 570 sites on the East Coast and the Atlantic Ocean that are bubbling up methane. It's everywhere. And so things are melting, and then it lifts moisture up into the air, and this moisture travels across the top of the world and changes. It's not all about global warming. It's also about climate chaos. Those of you who keep up with the news know how stormy and crazy and things have become.
Hottest month ever, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, you first.
You're asking the questions. I'm just here to please you.
Oh. as you've learned more about the science, it is not the effect on the sea ice, which is what affects the culture of these villages, has been so dramatic. You describe it as where there used to be 9 months of sea ice, 9 months for these hunters to travel to their various hunting grounds to find the walrus, to find the seal, to find the narwhal.
Yeah.
There's now as little as 2.
Yeah, so the ice used to come in mid-September and go out in mid-June. When I first went there, you never thought about the ice. It was just there. And now, yes, sometimes in March, sometimes in April, sometimes in May, sometimes in January. But so this year it was a kind of cold year up there, and everyone was excited, and they maybe had three or four months of hunting. But then I got a tweet from Jason Box, who's a great young glaciologist who works on the ice sheet, and he said, I don't know what's happening, but this omega-shaped clump of warm air is heading north up over Greenland. And then a friend of ours from Umanak said, yes, on April 8th, this massive warm air came and all the ice melted, sea ice melted that day, and it was over. And so, it doesn't really matter whether they have 1 month or 6 months, they can't depend on it. So it would be like if every grocery store in LA was closed indefinitely, or every once in a while they opened, you can't understand how to live. And then, everything starts coming apart.
And what does it matter for us here that this fascinating and vibrant culture is dying?
Well, you know, I just think of the pairing of climate and culture, that that cultural diversity is as intertwined and as important as biological diversity. So that having these people who are in the against all odds in the 21st century are living a traditional life, but fully cognizant of the modern world, that with a language intact, they have a way of knowing themselves and their world with language that, as they say, it not only describes the place but tells you how to behave when you get there, how to behave in front of the weather, how to make sure that the concept of sila is alive in everything you do, that this awareness of consciousness all around you is alive, and therefore there is a sense of respect and dignity and of action that makes a culture thrive. So you lose that, which is to me immense, and because we've you know mostly killed off all of the indigenous cultures that we came across in the lower latitudes, and so it makes it even more precious that there are some still alive. And also in terms of just our weather, our I call it bad weather. I'm so sick of the words climate change. I just call it bad weather. That the Arctic drives the climate of the world. The most important the most important word is albedo, coming from the Latin alba, which means white. So the reflectivity of snow and ice all over the world, and it could be in Colorado, it doesn't have to be just the Arctic, radiates 80% of solar heat back into space. It's what keeps, the Arctic has been keeping our latitudes temperate. It's the natural air conditioner. It's been functioning for a long time, 10,000 years this way. And as things start to melt, as sea ice disappears, as the Greenland ice sheet collects ash from wildfires in the west and soot from industry in China, and now algae blooms on top of the ice and makes it darken, it can absorb more heat and it deflects less heat. So you have all these feedback systems that seem kind of, you know, insignificant and fragile, but when they start adding up, you get a hotter and hotter world exponentially, as we are all experiencing. And so the Arctic is important in just about every way you can imagine.
You went back to Greenland in 2012?
Yeah.
What was it like then? What had changed?
Oh, everything. So, you know, when we used to go out on these hunts, even in 2004, people were still jolly. There was lots of kidding around, like, you know, like all rural communities, lots of teasing each other and fun and the prospect of getting food for your village, and the dogs were great. They were beautiful, and it's just great to be out of the village and living on the ice. And in 2012, I went in May, which was, they had only had ice for that month, but we were all going to the ice edge, which is usually a time of celebration because, you know, the ice starts to come apart in these kind of wide canals of open water, and it's where all life comes. You know, there was a pod of beluga whales, and there was a walrus, and eider ducks fly in, and little auks are flying by, and it's just joyous because during winter, you know, it is a frozen sheet, or at least it used to be, where you just didn't see any life. So, but it was just not a happy time. No, there were no jokes. No one was laughing. Jens was away, so I traveled with Mamrit, his brother-in-law. He had had a shattered ankle when he went across the ice sheet by himself to hunt muskox because there was nothing else to feed his dogs, and he shattered his ankle, and it took 2 weeks to get to the hospital, and so he wasn't in great shape. So we went to the ice edge. The guys, the younger guys, his younger brother and his two younger brothers, got a couple of walrus and a Yeah, a couple of walrus. And then, you know, we've made camp. And then suddenly during the night, these other hunters come and camp in back of us. You know, that's just never done. They were usurping our hunting territory. But, you know, the Greenlanders are cool. They never say anything. And the next day, I hear all this screaming and a dog howling, and this man is beating his dog with a snow shovel just over the head. And I have never seen any violence towards animals of any kind ever in 20 years in Greenland. And I jumped up and tried to run over to, you know, to, I don't know what I was going to do, and Mamrik grabbed my arm. He said, no, 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 you might be hurt too if you go there. So no one said, actually the dog survived, but nobody said, you know, the mood just really changed. And we, you know, very early in the morning, we packed everything up and just got the hell out of there. And, you know, they were so horrified by what we had seen. And then on the way back to Connacht, Mamrik was trying to untangle the trace lines. You know, you sort of step in the middle of these trace lines because the dogs go underneath each other all the time and, you know, they have their own society. And he was trying to untangle them, and the dogs ran ahead and caught his leg, his bad leg, and he was dragged for a long way. I was on the set and tried to stop the dogs, but because they didn't know me, they didn't stop. I can stop Jens's dog, but not Mamrik's. And finally they stopped. But it represented to me the end of life on the ice, the end of their culture, the end of the days when everything was, even when things went really wrong, which it can do very quickly in the Arctic because you're at the mercy of the weather, even that was always a joke, like, oh yeah, we were caught in a blizzard, we had to go home. But it was always happy because they knew they would be able to go out another day and everything would be all right. And that was just gone. And it was a really sad day.
Jens once told you something about the ice.
Yeah. One day we were standing there, you know, he was standing there looking out at the ice, and he said, I don't see the ice wanting to come back. This man is beating his dog with a snow shovel just over the head. And I have never seen any violence towards animals of any kind ever in 20 years in Greenland. And I jumped up and tried to run over to, you know, to, I don't know what I was going to do, and Mamrik grabbed my arm. He said, no, 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 you might be hurt too if you go there. So no one said, actually the dog survived, but nobody said, you know, the mood just really changed, and we, you know, very early in the morning, we packed everything up and just got the hell out of there. And, you know, they were so horrified by what we had seen. And then on the way back to Connacht, Mamrik was trying to untangle the trace lines. You know, you sort of step in the middle of these trace lines because the dogs go underneath each other all the time and, you know, they have their own society. And he was trying to untangle them, and the dogs ran ahead and caught his leg, his bad leg, and he was dragged for a long way. I was on the set and tried to stop the dogs, but because they didn't know me, they didn't stop. I can stop Jens's dog, but not Mamrik's. And finally they stopped. But it represented to me the end of life on the ice, the end of their culture, the end of the days when everything was, even when things went really wrong, which it can do very quickly in the Arctic because you're at the mercy of the weather, even that was always a joke, like, oh yeah, we were caught in a blizzard, we had to go home. But it was always happy because they knew they would be able to go out another day and everything would be all right. And it just, that was just gone. And it was a really sad day.
Jens once told you something about the ice.
Yeah. He, one day we were standing there, you know, he was standing there looking out at the ice, and he said, I don't see the ice wanting to come back. The ice is everything we are. Without it, it will be a disaster. Without ice, we are nothing at all.
In a couple of minutes, we're going to take questions if you'd like to join the conversation. It's 800-989-8255.
No, but we're going to talk, mention Paris.
But first, yeah. As I've been cued, we saw Jens and Mamaret in Paris. We all went for the climate change conference that started in early December, just after the terrorist incidents in Paris. In fact, they were there.
Yes, we were. Should I?
Yeah.
Can I?
Yeah, you
talk
can
now?
Have it now.
Yeah. We were going to do several events and a small film, in which we brought a dog sled to Paris, and Jens and Mamaret, and they and we had a dog trainer in France train 10 white standard poodles to pull the sled. It was, you know, it was in jollier times before the savagery in Paris. And, you know, we thought people might at least find it slightly interesting. And then Jens was going to get off and give a talk about how the Arctic drives the climate of the world, what has happened to his culture. And so it was, you know, meant to raise awareness while having having fun with it. Well, of course, the horrible things happened. We were all staying in the 11th arrondissement, and we were just a few blocks from the Bataclan and from the other places where people were mowed down. And poor Jens and Mamaret were just terrified. Not, I mean, these are, you know, these are courageous people, but they didn't, you know, Jens said, I don't understand why people who have nothing to do with each other, who came from another country, are killing people here. I don't understand why they would be killing each other. That was hard to explain. But so I'd rented a six bedroom loft, and we ended up just, you know, we were sort of told to stay in our neighborhoods, which we would anyway. You know, anything else would be a sort of betrayal of the solemnity of Paris after all of this. And we ended up, I got to cook for them. So I cooked every night for them. And then Jason Bartlett, the glaciologist, came, and David Buckland from Cape Farewell came and stayed. So I was cooking for between 5 and 15 people every night, which is a pleasure in Paris because the food is so great. But I'd say, we're having salad now. This is sort of joking. And you know, I always had lots of meat, but it was a sort of wonderful exchange, given all the sadness in what was going on in the world at every level of you know, I've been eating walrus and seal for 20 years, and now they had to eat my food. But they, they just reminded us that they had been displaced in a way that many, many people already are displaced, not only from wars and political oppression, but also from climate, that we, many, many of us, will be climate migrants. And we were just so astonished at how gracefully they accepted their fate.
It's interesting, some of the people who were the engine of the agreement that was finally reached in Paris were Marshall Islanders and other islanders from the Pacific who will say that any agreement would come too late for them, that even if we shut off the carbon generation right now, there's enough baked into the system that it will be too late for them. Is it going to be too late for Greenland?
Oh, yes. It's too late for all of us, really. We can do things. We can slow things down. We can work on things, but it's not going to be the same world. You know, we have lived in this interglacial paradise, an absolute paradise, and that paradise is, as Milton would say, now lost. And it is going to be a different world, a challenging world, and many great things will be lost. Many cultures, many cities, many people. You know, as Julian Dowdeswell, the head of glaciologists at Cambridge, who I happened to be in a plane with one time going to Connacht, said, you know, it's too late to stop global warming. All that there's left to do, which is a lot, is to deal with the consequences. And we just have to work very, very hard at that, very diligently and very inventively and very compassionately, because there are going to be social justice problems that will go beyond what we've imagined so far. And with that, but okay, I'm going to end. Can I end it now?
Yeah.
So, you know, there was one wonderful Japanese man who lives in Sihanoukville, who came there following a climber in the early 70s and just stayed on. And I went to see him. He's just a wonderful man. And I said, Iku, and there's now only two people left in Sihanoukville, which used to have 65 or 70 people. I said, how are you going to survive? And he looked up and he said, I don't know, perhaps just on beauty, as we looked out at icebergs going by in the open water. So I end with that. You know, we live in a beautiful world. It might look different, but it is still beautiful.
And I think the staff is going to be coming around with microphones. And yeah.
Actually, three questions. Are there any pictures of Connacht? Because I've never seen Greenland, and I can't imagine what it looks like when you actually land in a town. Any slides of it?
No.
Okay, no worries. That's why
you could go online.
The internet,
and see them,
yes, indeed. Yeah. And are people emigrating in large numbers, and where are they going?
They're not leaving Connacht. They're just going south.
They're going south.
Not leaving Greenland. They're going south.
I mean, not Greenland. Yeah, they're going south.
And Neil, can I listen to your show on the internet? Is there an app for your station?
I miss you
desperately.
Oh, well, thank you. That's
I do.
You go on Hawaii Public Radio. It's especially good if you sleep in late.
Okay. I do, actually.
Yeah. So catch Morning Edition, and I'm on Tuesday, Wednesdays, and Thursdays with the Pacific News Minute.
Fabulous.
Thank you.
Next
question. Thank you. Hi. Fascinating talk, and so good to have the respective histories there in the both of you. I was wondering if the Greenland government is sort of trying to, obviously they can't change all of global warming, but is trying to say, well, this place, perhaps a town, we will try to maintain, you know, some of the hunting, et cetera, you know, sort of supporting it in a way just because it is such a precious and unique culture.
No, I mean, and they wouldn't need to because it's the Greenlanders themselves who dictate how things are going to be, unlike a lot, you know, because it's they rule themselves. They don't have a lot of people like us telling them what to do. So, yeah, and actually Jens was in charge of, you know, maintaining traditional. You can't do it without ice. You know, it's not there. And they will, you know, people like Jens and his family will stay there to the bitter end, no matter what. It's just the younger people are leaving.
Yeah. The Greenland government is leasing areas in the Davis Strait and other places to search for oil, and there's quite a bit of extractive industries on land in terms of iron ore, that sort of thing. So.
The name Greenland has always sounded like marketing or euphemism, and now, I wonder if the Inuit refer to Greenland, the territory, by that name. Or some variant on that name, and if it is going to get greener as the climate changes.
It is getting greener. I'm thinking of moving to South Greenland and growing hay and raising sheep. But yeah, it was called Kalalisa. It, you know, it means big island. It was a Viking name, you know, translation of a Viking name. Trying to learn, what's his name?
Iceland didn't work out so well.
Eric the Red, thank you. Eric the Red was trying to lure people to move there. Silly guy.
Yeah, I'd just like to first thank you very much for your guys' time. I really did enjoy it. I really did enjoy your anecdotes. I had a question about probably the happier times, 20 years ago. I just had a question about how was it like being a child to adolescence, you know, growing up in the village? How was that? I'm sure having a lot faster than in L.A.,
fantastic. It's the childhood I think anyone would have wanted. Partly because, you know, there's 6 months of 24-hour-a-day light. And also there are no cars in the villages, not the little ones. So children can wander anywhere. There's nothing that will hurt them. The odd polar bear might come in, but you know, they know how to behave in. During the summer, they're out. There are no restrictions on when they have to go to bed or anything. They're just out. When they get tired, they go home and go to bed. Or if they get hungry, they go home and eat something. I never heard a child complain, no matter what. Even 30 below zero on a dog's head, never. A little, you know, 5-year-old sitting on Jens's lap. Now, one time he pointed his feet, sort of cold. Okay, so his grandmother, who was sitting next to me, just whipped up a pair of boots and while the dog's head was still moving, put them over his feet, and then he just smiled. And
so it was along the way.
And also they were taught how to do everything. So by the time they were 7, they could handle a whip. The dogs weren't whipped. It was just an auditory signal. They could throw a harpoon. They could fire a gun. They could, you know, if fish were caught, they knew how to prepare them to eat. They, you know, they knew how to do everything.
And then I guess last, if I could just touch on like how like romances happened or how relationships were formed.
Well, it's a village. Everyone is well, actually, it was interesting. In a town like Umanok, which is a slightly larger town, they had a little house which was just for teenagers. No adults were allowed in there. The teenagers could go there. I don't know what, probably any time. But I mean, they went to school and stuff, but you know, on the weekends, and they were just allowed to do whatever they did. So it's this kind of wonderful society. Well, you know, you're alone out there on the ice, so there weren't too many bad things that could come in. But children and young adults were really respected.
My question is, what do you cook with? How do you cook it? And in what? Where do you get, what do you burn? I mean, I'm assuming that's oil or something.
Yeah. They had these old-fashioned Swedish Prima stoves, sort of camp stoves, but a little, not small like the backpacking ones, but a pretty big single flame. They carried a battered, big, like a spaghetti pot on the back of the sled. So this is modern hunting society. And then they brought white gas or whatever it is they use for it, and which all imported from Denmark. But to get water, the old ice, the multi-year ice out on the top of the new ice, that we would go buy a piece with the dog's head and with that tuk, the iron bar, we'd chunk off big chunks, put them on the sled, and then, you know, cut them up smaller and put them in. The first thing you do when you make camp is turn on the Primus and put a chunk of big ice in the pot to melt for water. And first you drink, because strangely you get very thirsty out there. And then more was put in for cooking, and everything was boiled.
So what did they do before all these modern conveniences?
Ate it raw. They still do. I was two women on the beach at about, I don't know, 3 a.m, where I saw them butchering a seal, and they took out the liver like that and were holding it up and beckoning me to take a bite. It was still steaming.
What did they do for water before that?
Oh, that's a good question. Yes, blubber lamps. Thank you. Would you? Yes, blubber lamps.
Come on up.
Yeah, I'm kind of. I've been traveling for about a month.
It's almost no wood whatsoever. Wood is very precious.
There is no wood. Yeah. There is in Alaska, but not Greenland.
Yeah, but they had some wood implements, but it was very precious.
Yeah. Anyway, yes, blubber lamps. So blubber, you know, it's not. It's how they kept warm and how they, it just gives off a little bit of a flame. But in Arctic, in Nunavut, in Arctic Canada, there are people who still, women who still tend blubber lamps out of camp. It somehow, that was kind of lost in Greenland, but that's because they had Vikings to help them, whereas the Inuit people in Nunavut, you know, had slightly different influences.
A couple things. Did you say that Greenland is going to be drilling for oil?
They have let out leases to explore for oil. As of the last I heard, they had not found any. But yes, they have let out leases to explore for oil.
Many of us thought this was a terrible idea, but, you know.
Okay.
Self-rule. They can do what they want.
Okay. Compute that for a minute. But I was wondering about the wood. The sleds were made of wood, weren't they?
Right. Brought in by ship from Denmark. Mm-hmm. So when I first went there was a once-a-year supply ship to the northern mm-hmm. villages. And I spent one summer with a man and his daughter and son, little kids then. And he had built his own little shack. He was a Danish guy, but he had kind of dropped out. And he said, well, I was halfway through building my house, and the supply ship couldn't get here because it was too cold. It iced up too early. So we had no nails in the entire village for a whole nother year. It teaches patience. Yeah.
Yeah. And finally, the Inuits across the north, are they in communication with each other as a culture across the different countries of the...
Yes, there's the Inuit Circumpolar Conference. It happens every 4 years in some Arctic nation. And it's just like that they let me go. I came with the Greenland contingent. It's not really open to other people, but it operates just like the UN. Everyone has on headphones because the dialects are so extreme. And then there's the Russians who speak Russian, so it includes all the way to Chukotka. But it's very dynamic. They're very much involved in things. Yes? Or, I'm sorry, I'm not. Yes?
I'd like to thank both of you and congratulations for the excellent presentation.
Thank you.
I have a question. I'm Guatemalan American, and according to the Mayas, man had taken advantage of all the resources that they thought the world would end in the year 2000, but not exactly 2000, after 2000. Now, according to the glaciologists, is there an estimate about how long the world would be able to survive if we still try to make it survive? Thank you.
If there is, they haven't told me. But I would be the last to know. I don't think so.
One more?
Oh, the pressure. I'm sorry, everybody. I was wondering, did you find that the cultures were in any way superstitious or did anything that sort of, I guess, were a little outside of the normal?
Well, I mean...
tell the story about the shaman about the polar bear.
Yeah. So Jens is a special person. He has some special. He's a natural leader. He would never call himself a shaman. He thinks that's not appropriate for the 21st century. But he, one time when we were holed up in, you know, weathered in somewhere, he began telling a story. And when he talks, everybody falls silent. And so he said, well, I was in my tent, and normally we just live in tents that are put up over two sleds put together, these old battered canvas tents. I was in my tent, and the dog started barking, and I went outside. I saw there was a polar bear up on this little piece of ice, and so I grabbed my rifle, and I went running towards the bear. And suddenly, and the bear was at the top, and suddenly the bear turned around, and I saw that it had a human face. And he said, and so I went away. And he said several times that bear has beckoned to me to come with it. He said, but I'm a modern man, and I couldn't leave my family, and I couldn't leave my society in a time when so much is, we're trying so hard to survive in the modern world. It just wouldn't be right, so I couldn't do it.
So instead of going over the hill with the bear, he became the...
He's sort of the equivalent of a senator from northern Greenland. He's now a politician, but a good one. Yeah. So he goes to, you know, conferences all over Europe, and but he loves nothing more than being out with his dogs. He still has all his dogs, and that to him is nirvana.
Thank you all for coming. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.